Hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, January 25th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and before we bring in our guests, literary agent Linda Connor and Roy Peter Clark, I just want to say a word about Etta James, who died last week. She was 73, and we opened with her song Time After Time from the album of that name. And we always close out with her song as well, and we'll play her again at the break. I've loved her for at least the last 20 years, and sorry she's no longer with us in the flesh, but we have her great music. First up is Linda Connor. She's the founder and president of the Linda Connor Literary Agency, which she launched in 1996. She's one of my favorite people. She represents 75 authors of adult nonfiction and is also an author, co-author of 8 books. She's the former editor-in-chief of various magazines, Weight Watchers magazine. She was an editor at 17, Red Book, Woman's World. She's a member of the Association of Authors Representatives, the American Society of Journalists and Authors, and the Authors Guild, and so much more. Let's bring her on. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Good. Great to have you back again. For those listeners who didn't hear you when you were on last, will you talk a little bit about how you began your agency?
Sure. As you mentioned, I had been an author and a magazine editor for most of my career, and loved whatever I was doing at the time, but did experience a bit of burnout toward the end of my magazine editing career and moved into books, and gradually thought that I should be doing something else, something where I would be my own boss and have my own business. And even though I have never worked in publishing, in book publishing, at a book publishing house myself, I was the author of books, and that was my connection with book publishing, and thought that maybe I would give agenting a try. I had never worked at a literary agency either, so I sort of took a flyer and went to see if I could accomplish that. And it did turn out very well for me, fortunately. I had many friends who were writers, and many of my earliest clients were fellow members of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, of which I'm still a member, as you mentioned. And so many of my friends from that organization came with me when I started my business as an agent 16 years ago. And little by little, my company grew. Word of mouth was very good and continues to be good. And so I grew from a small group of authors to the 75 or 85 that I have right now.
Now, do you agent your own books?
Well, I'm not writing books any longer. So
when you did, though, you were an agent as well, I think, at least part of the time.
Yes, that's correct. I didn't sell any of my books to publishers, but one approached me when I was an agent, so I did do that book myself, but I was not pitching my own books to publishers as a newer agent.
Sure. Let's talk about your list, primarily nonfiction.
Exclusively nonfiction.
Okay. Did you ever at any point represent fiction, or talk about how you came to solely represent nonfiction?
Well, in fact, I did represent fiction at the very, very beginning. In fact, my very first client was someone I met at a book signing, and he was actually the forward writer to the book that was being presented that evening. And so he got up at the podium, and when he was introduced as the forward writer, he said, "By the way, is there a literary agent in the house? If so, I have a wonderful novel that I'd love for you to take a look at." And he was literally my first client. I had just started my business around that time, and I just thought, well, I have to start somewhere. So I offered to take a look at his book, and I did acquire it. And he was happy, and I was happy, and I went on to sell about 15 more books for him, all fiction. And it became readily apparent to me that I should really focus on nonfiction because that was something I felt I had much more expertise in. I had, because of my background in magazines, I had worked on articles primarily of interest to women, and I felt that's what I knew best. And so even though I was working with this novel author for a number of years, I realized that fiction was not really my thing. So he was my one and only fiction author.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest this morning is Linda Connor. She's the founder and president of the Linda Connor Literary Agency in New York City. We can't help but talk about self-publishing and print-on-demand and e-books and all of that, and sort of with the advent of those forms, and also with their, especially with print-on-demand books and self-published books and self-published e-books, you know, just like inundating publishing. How is that affecting the agent's role, or how do you see it affecting the agent's role?
Well, there's no question that there's tremendous excitement about the world of self-publishing and or ebook publishing, and many of my clients have asked me, can I represent their ebook? Can I represent their self-published book? The feeling seems to be that most authors still want to work with agents. They still want to go the traditional route. That's not to say that it isn't a great opportunity for a lot of authors to try to self-publish, and many people do, and many of them do approach me and talk to me about what they're doing, how I can help them with what they're doing, that sort of thing. It does give some authors the opportunity to get their work out there if they cannot get it out there through traditional means. And some of them do very well. Some of them do financially very well and get tremendous following for their books and for their future work. It's just that my understanding from talking to a lot of people in the business is that unless you already have some public recognition, it's very hard for the average writer to do well self-publishing. You need to spend a lot of time promoting yourself online. You need to spend a lot of time worrying about distribution and other issues that traditionally have fallen to the publisher. And it sounds to me from, you know, random sampling of talking to self-published authors that in time, while they're happy with the money they make and they're happy with the response they get from readers, eventually they come to the realization that they don't want to spend as much time as is necessary being a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them express a lot of frustration that I want to be a writer. I want to write. I want to spend my time doing that activity. I don't want to spend a lot of my time worrying about the books and worrying about getting it out there and worrying about promoting myself. And that seems to take up a lot of their time sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
And they get frustrated that way. So while I'm not suggesting that people should not try to do that if they can, and certainly there are more and more opportunities for people to do that because there are more and more self-publishing outlets to help them do that. If it works for you, great. It's just that, you know, I'm finding that most people who come to me still want to try to get published the traditional
mm-hmm.
way.
And it also seems, because I get so many books every day, actually, for the show, from authors or publicists wanting their writers to be on the show. And those that are self-published, I would say 99% of those books are just not of the quality that really makes me want to read them. I mean, there's typos. There's, you know, the cover looks kind of amateurish. I mean, there's various things where, you know, most self-published writers don't put the time and the money into creating the sort of book that would come from a publisher.
And Barbara, you're making the same exact argument that publishers are making now for themselves. They're saying, there's more to getting a book out there than just printing it and putting it out there.
Right.
There's the whole editing process. There's the whole discussion of marketing and cover design and layout and publicity. And there are so many steps, as you say, that are outside of the realm of the average writer. as you mentioned before, I was an author for a time, and I would not begin to do any of these things now. Mm-hmm. They just seem too time-consuming, too overwhelming, too much of a learning curve. I considered myself, when I was a writer, someone who wanted to focus on that and would not want to get involved in self-publishing now.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned platform, and that's something that whether you're self-publishing or going through an agent and traditional publisher, you kind of do have to think about when you're publishing nonfiction. But to what extent do you like your authors or your potential authors to have a platform? How healthy a platform? How much do they have to be already out there for you to take on a new author as a client?
For better or worse, it's very important. It's very important for me because it's very important for publishers. I keep explaining to new authors that I consider myself the middleman. I'm simply the messenger, and the message is from publishers, you have to have a platform, especially in nonfiction. In fiction, it's not as critical, although it's becoming more so. But mm-hmm. for nonfiction, it's very important. And what I mean when I say platform, which is probably similar to what other agents say, is a following, an audience, a built-in audience before you go to sell your book. It is not, as many people think, academic credentials. That is a given. If you're a doctor, you have to have a medical degree. If you're whatever your area of expertise is, we expect you to have an equivalent degree in that. What we talk about when we what we mean when we talk about platform is, what kind of exposure do you have to the public at large? Have you ever done TV? Have you ever done national TV? Have you ever been written up in a major publication, or have you had articles published written by you in major publications? Do you have a large internet following? More than ever before, this has become a critical piece of the platform. Do you have a website that is heavily trafficked? Do you blog on big popular websites? Do you do a lot of public speaking to large groups? These are the questions I routinely ask, and I mean every day, when I'm approached by a new would-be author who has a book. And I don't know if it's sad or funny or strange, but when people come to me, what they're promoting first and foremost is their book idea.
Mm-hmm.
And once upon a time, a book idea was the most important thing. Right now, the book idea is not the most important thing. Publishers may tell you otherwise, but it's really not. They want to know what kind of audience reach the author has
mm-hmm.
to help them sell the book. They need to be able to guarantee a certain number of sales if they're going to go to their editorial board and push for a particular new title.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can bring them something to indicate that you have a big following already built in that they can piggyback onto with their own publicity department, then they're probably going to say no, even if they think it's a great idea. There are so many times, reluctantly, I have to pass on what I know is a very good idea because the author just does not have the platform to support the book.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about people getting in touch with you. Do you like queries online? Do you like snail mail? What do you like?
I like queries online. I like short emails that summarize what the book is and who you are as the author. For the reason I just said,
mm-hmm.
platform is so important. I'm really going to focus on what your platform is. So the more information you can give me in your email, the better. Do not send me a full proposal electronically until I ask for one. If I get, if I have a good reaction to what you send me in an email about yourself and your book, I will ask for the proposal. So have the proposal ready to go. But it starts with giving me some basic information about who you are, what your platform is, and what your book is.
Mm-hmm. And then, in terms of you get the manuscript or you get the proposal, And do you want it to be as perfect as possible? I mean, you know, I hear new writers especially say, well, you know, I really want the agent, whatever agent takes me on, to really get involved with this and help me to make it perfect and help me with a title. How much of that do you need to have in place when you're looking at the proposal to begin with, which, you know, also doesn't have to do with how much you end up getting involved with it, but how much has to be there?
It should be as close to perfect as you can make it. You know, as I have said many times, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. And I'm not saying I originated that thought, but I do think about it a lot when I get something submitted to me from somebody I don't know. If there are a lot of errors, if it looks like it's sloppily written, I mean, I have to say that seldom happens. Writers tend to approach agents in a very meticulous, orderly way. At least that's my experience. I think they do a lot of reading in advance of what agents are looking for, which is great. They seem to have access to a lot of books and a lot of websites about how to put together a proposal. They all seem to follow more or less the same format. I noticed there must be one person dispensing this information because they all seem to be written in the same exact way. I invariably, if I'm interested in something, I tell the writer how I like proposals to be put together. And it isn't so much that I rip them apart and start from scratch as much as I tell them to put the information in a different order. And what I tell people the order should be is to start with the author bio, which nobody ever does because they don't think that that's as important as a summary of the book. But as I said before, since publishers are focused so heavily on the platform, they want to know right off the bat who the author is and what the author brings to the table. So I always say if you have a good platform, then your author bio should be the first thing in the proposal. But in general, the proposal should be written very, very well. I mean, you can't write a proposal too well. It can't be too perfect. And in terms of title, I used to get a lot more submissions where it would say, like, working title in parentheses and then some kind of slapdash title. And I would always say, please spend time thinking of the best possible title and subtitle, because most of the time a nonfiction book has a title and a subtitle. Think of the best possible title and subtitle you can. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, if it's really, really good, that's what's going to knock an editor's socks off. I have sold many books where the editor says, you know, oh my God, I really love that title. It was great. And that's what grabbed me from the very beginning. And when I get something where the title is not that good or could be improved upon, that's where I step in, and I really do work very hard with the author to come up with the best possible title, because I do know it's important. And even though, as your listeners may know, many times publishers will change the title before the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of control over that, and authors have to sign a publishing contract that acknowledges that the publisher has the final say on the title. However, that's not to say that you should be lazy about it and not do your best to come up with the best title right off the bat, because that might be the clincher. That mm-hmm. might be the thing that really grabs the editor more than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, like with my book, they loved Pen on Fire, but the subhead, they said, oh, we're going to change it. And I had some difficulty with what they changed it to, but it's like, okay, mm-hmm. I'm right. not going to fight that battle. But, mm-hmm. you know, they kept the one, they kept the main one. But yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's so much collaboration that goes on once you do get the book deal, and what they want to do and what you're good with or not good with.
That's right.
Linda, we're at the end of our time. Do you have any last words or advice for the listeners who perhaps are working on a nonfiction book idea?
I would say the best advice I could give is don't give up. If you have a lot of determination to get your book published, don't get discouraged. It's very hard to get an agent. It's very hard to get a publisher. It's easy to get your book self-published, and if you want to go that route, by all means, give it a whirl. But if you want to try the traditional book publishing route, you should just keep trying. Don't give up after you've gotten a dozen or two dozen rejections. There are many other people out there who might be interested in what you have to say. So keep at it until you get the agent and the publisher you want.
Great. Thank you so much, Linda, for
my pleasure.
Taking
Thanks
the
a lot,
time.
Barbara.
Bye-bye. That was Linda Connor. She is founder and president of the Linda Connor Literary Agency in New York City. I've known her for quite a few years and have just so much respect for her and really enjoy her. And she's really quite funny as well, even though she would never admit it. And that didn't really come through in this talk, but she's great. She's a great person. When we come back from our break, we will hopefully have Roy Peter Clark on the line. He is author of Help for Writers, 210 Solutions to the Problems Every Writer Faces, published by Little Brown. He's vice president and senior scholar at the Poynter Institute. I can't wait to talk with him. We're going to, instead of playing Come Back Baby, as we always do at the break, which is by Brian Barrett, we're going to play another Etta James song. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Oh, Lord, why did you send the darkness to me? And the shadows forever to be. Where's the light I'm longing to see? Love once met me by the old willow tree. Now you've gone and left nothing to me. Nothing but a sweet memory. Branches green along the stream that runs to the sea. Listen to my plea. Listen, willow, and weep for me. Gone my lover's dream, lovely summer dream. Gone and left me here to weep my tears into the stream. Sad as I can be, hear me, willow, and weep for me. Whisper to the wind and say that love has sinned to leave my heart a-breaking and making a moan. Murmur to the night to hide her starry light, so none will find me sighing and crying all alone. Weep in a willow tree, weep in sympathy. Bend your branches down along the ground, cover me. When the shadows fall, bend, oh willow, and weep for me. I want you to weep for me, willow tree. Thank you. to the wind and say that love has sinned to leave my heart a-breaking and making a moan. Murmur to the night to hide her starry light so none will find me sighing and crying all alone. Oh, weeping willow tree, weeping sympathy, bend your branches down along the ground and cover me. When the shadows fall, bend, oh willow, and weep for me. Weep, weep, oh willow tree, I want you to weep for me.
I lost my mojo.
You lost it?
Oh, love.
Where'd it go?
I don't know, but I found it. I found it on Writers on Writing.
Writers on Writing?
Wednesday mornings at 9. 9 a.m. in the morning.
With Barbara DeMarco Barrett and Marie Stone?
That's them.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and this show, along with many others, is podcast. You can go to writersonwriting.blogspot.com or just go to iTunes and subscribe to PenOnFire/Writers on Writing. And you should be able to find it. We've been having some podcast trouble, and if you just go directly to the blog, you can download many shows from there, and hopefully our problems will be fixed soon. If the podcast gods are with us, they'll be fixed soon. What else can I tell you? Etta James, this show is dedicated to her. She died last week at the age of 73, so we're playing her music at the top, middle, and end of the show. We always play I'd Rather Go Blind at the end, but wow, going to miss her. Our next guest is Roy Peter Clark. He is Vice President and Senior Scholar at the Poynter Institute, one of the most prestigious schools for journalists in the world. He's taught writing at every level for more than 30 years and has spoken about the writer's craft on the Oprah Winfrey Show and NPR and at news organizations from the New York Times to the Sowetan in South Africa. And he's here today to talk about Help for Writers, 210 Solutions to Problems Every Writer Faces, published by Little Brown. Hi, Roy.
Yeah, good morning, Barbara.
Good morning.
What an honor to be not just in your company, but in the company of the late, great Etta James.
Yeah, yes. Well, thank you so much for being here. And gosh, you know, I appreciate your book so much. I saw it, I think I told you, on the end cap at my local Barnes & Noble, where my book also was, and yours was there, and it's beautiful aqua shade, and I just had to have you on. I love how it's structured, and I love how the chapter titles say it all. And within each chapter, you have many subheads, so that it also makes the book the sort of book that you could simply open and read a section instead of having to start at the beginning. Will you talk a bit about the book and how it came about, and also how you structured it, how you came to structure it the way it is?
Well, this book probably has the most interesting history of the books I've worked on, because it was sort of conceived originally as a mobile phone application.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about podcasts, and when my first book, the first book I've done in this sequence for Little Brown, called Writing Tools, when it came out here at the Poynter Institute where I work, we did some very crude recordings of sort of summaries of the chapters, and next thing I knew, without any additional work on my part, it was on iTunes U, and was kind of, I don't know, at one point was like number one with a bullet or something like that. So it just became obvious that people were looking for all different kinds of ways to seek out good and helpful and practical advice for their writing. So after I bought my iPhone, I looked around and I said, you know, I think it would be kind of a cool thing if writers who were sitting in an airport somewhere trying to figure out, I don't know, what their story was all about, would be able to kind of download a kind of a friendly voice and try to gain some very specific advice, just to help you kind of a series of questions, a set of reliable strategies that you could use to solve an immediate problem. Now, that app is phone app is still under construction, but since then, it's grown into this 210 tool text called Help for Writers with an exclamation point after the word help. So it's not just help for writers, it's
help,
help for writers. And so if you think of it, the structure of the book sort of suggests the kind of rational architecture that you would need for some kind of a an online or mobile application. It has seven or eight stages of the writing process. For each of those stages, it has three very common and dominant problems, and for each of those problems, it has 10 solutions. So yes, it's meant to be kind of scannable, portable, your friendly writing coach away from home.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look for that. Let me know when it goes live.
I'll be happy to do so.
I can let our listeners know. But, you know, in terms of the book and you know, all the different sections, I mean, you have, you know, a lot here for beginning writers, but you also have a lot here for advanced writers,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially when you start talking about focus, because I find that focus can be a problem, especially when you have too much material and you don't know maybe where the story is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, a lot of us here at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida, where I've worked for more than 30 years now, we came under the influence of a great writing teacher named Donald Murray from New Hampshire. And Murray taught us a kind of a, sketched out a sort of a model of the writing process in the early 1980s. And we've been playing with that model ever since we learned it. And the language always changes except for the word focus. And so we've come to think and believe and act and teach as if focus is the central act of writing, the kind of cognitive act. What is this all about? What am I trying to say? What's the one thing I want my readers to learn or understand? And it doesn't mean you can't do a lot of other work before you find your focus, but when you do find a focus, and when you do find the right one for your report or your story or your project, everything else becomes easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure does, because that, you know, it's sort of like when you ask a writer who's working on a book, whether it be a memoir or a novel, to tell me in a sentence or two what your book's about, and you know, they're unable to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that perhaps it's not focused.
Well, I've learned. I was not a big follower or fan of Steve Jobs, you know, of Apple fame, until he died. And then I started reading more about him and realized that he had sort of had a long-lost sister, Mona Simpson, who was a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote a novel, I guess loosely based on his life, and I believe the first sentence goes something like, he was a man too busy to flush toilets. And I said, "Wow, that's. I wish I could have written a nonfiction lead about Steve Jobs or about somebody that was sort of as sharp and as direct and as concise as that one is." And
yes.
So that's a writer who understands where she's headed. And a writer who's probably set out a good path for the reader.
Mm-hmm. Because it's such a focused, detailed line that tells you so much about the character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What about something else you discuss in the book is the fear of having too limited a vocabulary to write? This is something I hear from especially new writers who feel that, you know, they haven't read enough or maybe they're just not intelligent enough or not, you know, they just don't have the vocabulary to become a great writer or even a good writer.
This is still a problem for me, Barbara, especially in certain areas of life. For example, if I ever had to go out and let's say writing a story about a body that was discovered in the woods, I would be totally fine with the body and the discovery. It's the woods that would freak me out. Which is to say that my idea of roughing it is sort of spending a night in the Holiday Inn or something like that. And so I would need a guide to look at a scene like that, and I would say, what is that thing? What's that thing sticking out of the tree?
Mm-hmm.
What do you call that? What's that greenish, mossy-looking stuff on the ground? What do you call that? And so one of the things that I've discovered as a sort of compensatory behavior is that reporting and research and curiosity will allow the words that you need to find you rather than thinking that you have to sit in a corner with your thinking cap on for the right word to come along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in that section you talk about paying attention, you know, to give yourself time to notice, go early and stay late, and I have found that as well. One chapter in my book came from sitting in a bar in San Francisco and making notes on a cocktail napkin of everything I was seeing. That if I was in my office or at least at my desk, I wouldn't have come up with those things. I wouldn't have come up with, you know, the blue Bombay gin bottle and the, you know,
exactly,
the signs and everything that, you know, you look to memory and it's not in your memory, maybe because you haven't seen it or you haven't seen it in years, and you sit there and you pay attention and you write that down.
Maybe this is why I feel I'm a better nonfiction writer than a fiction writer. Good fiction writers do research too, engage the real world as it is. But when I'm beginning with the notion that I'm writing a profile of a man or a woman, and I'm going to enter their world, I'm going to be a kind of, a sort of an ethnographer or anthropologist, and I'm going to discover worlds that I'm unfamiliar with. And in that world, there will be sacred objects, there will be totems and taboos, there will be various expressions of power or lack of power, of wealth or poverty. I'm going to look at the walls and ask the walls to talk to me. I'm going to see what people have on their desks, and what images surround them every single day of their lives, and I'm not necessarily going to be able to draw clear inferences from those things, but I'm going to be able to create a representation of that world that that readers can enter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the power of narrative as far as I'm concerned.
Mm. Interesting stuff. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Roy Peter Clark. The book we're discussing this morning is Help for Writers, 210 Solutions to the Problems Every Writer Faces, published by Little Brown, and it's in a beautiful aqua, my favorite color, shade. love it. You talk about the middle of the book, and you talk about the ending of your book. Talk about endings, because that's, you could talk about middles too, but these are two areas we have a lot of problems with. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, it's so easy to get off to a roaring start, and then you hit the middle, and you go, all right.
Right.
And then you get toward the end, and you go, oh, yeah.
And you're exhausted, and you're tired, and you have to write that ending at the point where you may care least about the material.
That is so true.
And where
true.
You're asking other people to care most. So I think what the book tries to do is to give you choices, and I think that's what the writer wants and needs. So it's not a matter of learning the secret of good endings, but it's a matter of learning, is having a toolbox on your workbench that has a variety of good and reliable methods of ending stories. Among these would be such things as giving at the ending or reminding people at the end of a story what occurs at the beginning. And so, in other words, sort of looking back and seeing how far you've traveled. This is the way The Great Gatsby ends, where the narrator, sort of looks out and at that green light on a distant dock, and has this the whole sense of a sort of American history and culture and feelings about love and wealth can come rolling back through time. And a lot of people quote that ending word for word. I can't do it, but I certainly have it sort of imprinted in my brain. And I kind of said to myself, you know, where did that ending actually come from? And when I went back, I realized that Scott Fitzgerald had planted it at the end of chapter one. At the end of chapter one, he sees Gatsby for the first time sitting at the end of this lawn looking out at this green light, which is, I guess, the end of Daisy's dock. Mm-hmm. And so this sense of returning home, coming full circle, but when you arrive there, nothing is exactly like it was the first time you saw it. And so that's a strategy that we could probably find hundreds of examples of in literature. And it's something that a writer can put on her workbench today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a great idea, because I think we think about that technique when we're writing shorter pieces, you know, the end of an essay, the end of an article, you kind of, or the end mm-hmm. of a short story, you know, try to circle back to the beginning somehow and close it up. And I haven't heard that talked about in that way in terms of, say, book ideas, you know, or, mm-hmm. or a book project where, you know, look to your beginning again and maybe even, I think you say in your book, you know, think about the end as you're brainstorming the beginning. And
I think you always. I've written some things where, both fiction and nonfiction, where it was clear to me where things would end up. And very often, it's said. It seems amazing to me that a writer could have this kind of vision, but it's said that J.K. Rowling knew where the seventh book in the Harry Potter series would end before she wrote a word of the first book.
Mm.
Now, I think she changed her mind a couple of times, but that kind of gravitational force, I'm not sure if it's gravitational force or it's momentum, it's inertia, but some powerful force drives you from where you are to that destination for you and for the reader.
Yeah, that's great. This time has just flown by. We have a couple of minutes left.
Okay.
Book length or project length, whatever. It seems so often writers want to write longer than they need to. Will you say a few words about length?
Well, funny you should ask, because just today, I was, in fact, just less than an hour ago, I was counting words in my latest manuscript, which has the title, the working title, How to Write Short.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew the contract with Little Brown. This will be my fourth book with Little Brown in just about 6 or 7 years. And the contract called for about 40,000 words. And as I did a word count on my computer, originally I realized that I was up to 37,000 words. And I said, wow, you know, I should be seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, and I hope it's not a train heading for me. But I've got more things to say. And so I'm in the process now of negotiating whether, in fact, we could get from 40,000 to 50,000 words. Now, I tend to be, I have to say, if this distinction means something to your listeners, it's somebody else's language who said, you know, I am a taker-outer rather than a putter-inner, which is to say that my inclination is to get working, build momentum, write as quickly as I can, write every day, forget about the word count, say what I want to say, and then draw it back through revision and through selection rather than compression in order to get to the length I'm worried about. I know that I can't write for as long, I can't publish as much as I may want to, but the discipline of saying what you have to say and then reining it in with the help of an editor, I think is very powerful. And it's the way I do books, and it's the way I do tweets. When I sit down to write on Twitter, I know that I'm limited to 140 characters, but I'm inclined to write about 180.
Mm-hmm.
And then take that, and with the help of that friendly little counter, to boil it down to the fewest words that will do the best job, which is, I think, one definition of good writing.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. That's great. And I just became your follower this morning, so I'll look forward to your
fantastic
tweets. thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, and please come back with your next book.
Anytime, Barbara, and good luck to good luck to all your listeners in terms of their writing. And it's not a bad thing to do to, if you're stuck for a minute, just to sit down and listen to a little Etta James to get you inspired to write.
So true. Thank you.
Okay.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
That was Roy Peter Clark. His book is Help for Writers, 210 Solutions to the Problems Every Writer Faces, published by Little Brown. And y'all really should check this book out, no matter what stage you are in your writing life. It's a good one. We're at the end of our time. What can I say? There's so much more to say. There's always more to say, but we have to go. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. The website for more info about the Pen on Fire Writers Salon and so much more is penonfire.com. Click on Writers Salon, and you'll get there. That's it. I hope you have a great week writing, and whatever it is that you have been trying to sit down and write, just start. Set the timer. Start writing. Set the timer for 10 minutes. Start going and just see what happens. Give yourself that permission to actually write awful stuff. And my guess is it won't be so awful by the time you're done. Again, we're going to close out with Etta James, the song we always play at the end is I'd Rather Go Blind.